former U.S. National Rugby Team captain.
Team captain.
Head coach and general manager.
General manager.
Now, the co-founder and CEO of the New England Free Jacks. Now, Full Contact CEO with Alex Magleby.
Welcome to Full Contact CEO. Today, I get to wrestle a tiger. I'm your host, Alex Magleby, and I am also the co-founder and chief executive of the New England Free Jacks. Today, I'm joined by friend, current CEO of U.S. Ski and Snowboard, two-time Olympic racer, and the second most famous tiger in the sports world. Tiger, thanks for joining me today. Great to have you on board.
Morning. Thanks, Alex.
Now, we're going to do a bit of a wordplay. Okay, I'm going to ask you a word and just say the first thing that comes to mind. The big green.
Hanover.
Mono ski.
Switzerland.
Grit.
Sport.
Murphy's versus Fievold.
Sad Main Street restaurant exodus, from what I've heard. Hanover's changing quickly.
Yeah. Well, Murphy's, to their credit, everybody's gone outdoors. So suddenly Hanover's actually a really cool town. It's like, why haven't we done this for decades, which is great.
I love it.
Yeah. Spring 2020.
One to be remembered.
The future.
Dealing with unknowns.
Rambo or Chuck Norris?
Sorry, I lost track. I'm supposed to be one word, right? Not a phrase.
Exactly. Just throw it. Changing the rules as we go.
Super tough.
So, Tiger, how'd you fall in love with skiing? I don't know if you know. I mean, obviously, rugby is a passion, but even a bigger passion for me is skiing, and that's what I that's my escape, and it always has been. Growing up in Utah, that was a great escape, and one of the reasons to Dartmouth was the ability to be able to ski all year, half the year. Now the family, we're in Lyme, just right down from the skiway. So skiing is just a massive part of my life. It's one of another reasons why I'm so excited for this conversation. How did you get your start?
Yeah, well, similar to your kids, I just grew up near mountains. So coming from Stowe, Vermont, my dad was a sales rep in the ski industry. My mom ran our local ski club. And I just thought everybody was a skier. You just got up in the morning, went up the mountain, and you went skiing. And in those days before snowmaking, maybe there were some frozen rocks and grass and no snow at all, maybe 3 feet of snow. You just never knew. And we just kind of slid over whatever was there.
Tammy Andrews, you hear that? Like leather straps on his skis, like old wood skis.
I did have leather boots when I was a young, really first started skiing. Yeah, lace-up leather boots. So that dates me.
I love Stowe. My wife and I got married. I don't know if you remember, Brooke. We got married at the ski meeting right there in town. And, right under that gondola. And it's a very, very good town. Interesting thing you said there about kind of the avoidance of rocks and just the difference in skiing back in the day, right? Did you find that your generation perhaps were forced because of that to learn some certain skills ski-wise that our kids don't necessarily get today? Especially
the variability in terrain that we were dealing with when we were kids was crazy. Because the snow cats, as they were called then, they weren't grooming machines because it wasn't grooming. Some of them just dragged a chain behind a horizontal piece of culvert that was rolling.
Yeah.
And so corduroy back then consisted of the only thing, maybe wore corduroy, but it was not found on the mountain. And it was normal. You just dealt with it. And the first time I went out west as a kid, I was shocked. I mean, the snow was soft. I mean, I didn't realize there was soft snow.
I'm like, what is this? This is crazy. And it's so deep. That's awesome. Skiing is a vehicle to teach. One of the great things that I've always found with skiing is you learn how to fall often and you learn how to get up. And, another great thing that I love about skiing also is you learn that individuality, like no friends on a powder day, right? Speaking of quality snow, and it's a very social sport, but at the same time, you learn pretty quickly that you're on your own a lot of the time, and that's the amazing experience of it. Making rapid decisions. I mean, from an athletic development perspective, like putting on my rugby hat, we often found skiers transition to our sport very well because they were able to keep themselves in a chaotic environment, get back to a power position. So the physical prowess to be able to do that was pretty great, making quick decisions based on the reactions they see. But probably there's a mentality there too of, learning to fall and you know, that individuality, but it's also a very, very social sport. How are you guys as an organization using that to increase participation, make the experience better? Like, what kind of initiatives are you guys tackling to share the greatness of skiing with the country?
Well, you know, I think we're fortunate in that our numbers are relatively steady. And when I say numbers, under 10-year-olds, under 12-year-olds, under 14-year-olds in the sport, it is getting increasingly expensive. It is a almost wholly white and wealthy sport, unfortunately, other than those that are living near places like the Dartmouth Skiway, where you can you can be in a junior program that doesn't cost much money, and in terms of recreation and sports programs, it's quite affordable. And in some places, it's not. So, but fortunately, there are a lot of people that live and work in the industry, and when you live in those towns in Squaw Valley or Stowe or Vail or Salt Lake City, the accessibility is pretty good and it's reasonably affordable. So our demographic tends to be skewed that way. And, you know, we're lucky because it's not a sport that's growing dramatically, but we have an ample base of athletes coming in. And the key thing at the elite level in terms of elite pipeline is making sure that the parents and the kids know, like, if you really want to be that good, then you need to be out there and ski a ton and develop those skills when you're 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, because that's when you develop the balance. And exactly what you just brought up, the ability to adapt your environment quickly, is a hallmark of somebody who's successful in a sport of careening down a mountain. Yeah. And yeah, so it's you know, if you're a kid growing up in Holiday, Utah, which is just below Salt Lake City, it's 9 miles to some of the most amazing skiing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that was my experience, right? I grew up right there on Foothill Drive, just south of west of Foothill Drive on 2300 East, literally walk out of the house to the UTA bus stop, have my skis as a 7-year-old, safe back then, to get on a bus by yourself, go the 30 minutes. And we usually always went to Park City. Mm-hmm. Park West even had a great youth program. And it was a great experience and it was so inexpensive. I mean, literally it's public transportation with rented skis or hand-me-downs from somebody else. And, you know, season pass for nothing, effectively. And so access was really easy. So fortunate to grow up kind of in that situation. I think you bring up a really good point there about access. Obviously, a lot of the ski mountains are very rural, so there's a certain demographic. But how do you guys, and there's an expense to it, but I think what I've noticed, you know, just from the outside, at the very least there's some stabilization in season ticket prices, as kind of there's been a consolidation. It's that guaranteed revenue for the companies that are doing that, the Vails of the world. Yes. They get that guaranteed revenue up front, but it's a lot less expensive to ski outside of the equipment, of course. Do you guys, and how are you guys approaching that as an NGB to give more opportunities for inclusivity and diversity, given the cost of entry?
Well, you're right. The consolidation in the ski industry, so two big players, Alterra, which is the company that has the Icon Pass, and they own, I think, in the range of 15, 16 ski areas. And Vail, of course, I think they're up to 37, 38 ski areas. So their Epic Pass, I mean, those passes are about $1,000. So season passes at a lot of ski areas were way higher than that. And also allows you to bounce around. So if you have one or both of them, in that case, depending if you're a crazy ski maniac, then you can ski a tremendous number of mountains. And so that helps at that level. Those are really people who are into it a lot. But what you're asking about are really the learn to ski, be introduced to programs, to how to snow, how to ride, how to ski. And there are some tremendous programs, one right here called YSA in Park City, and now they've extended into Salt Lake. They bring thousands of mostly Hispanic kids onto mountains to learn how to ski and ride. They also do bobsledding. They do snowshoeing, you know, backcountry skiing. Well, not backcountry, but snowshoeing, and teach them these sports. And it's incredible. And there will be a situation where one of those kids may become pretty good, but they're going to need a tremendous amount of support, you know, being raised by the village, so to speak, because of the expense moving up through. But there are also plenty of Hispanic and Black families that do have the economic means to get involved in our sports. And we have a history. We've had three black skiers on our alpine team in the past. Not many people know that. But it's a tiny percentage. We're not very diverse. So I would say those programs, the beauty of them is it teaches people, it exposes them to our sports. We're not hoping they become an Olympian someday. We're hoping that they learn something from it. And we're hoping our athletes get involved in those programs heavily so that those young kids are impacted by those athletes with whatever those young kids do. If we can change their lives by having them meet a Chloe Kim or a Michaela Schifrin or all of the others on our teams, they get a chance to see, you know, wow, that person's an Olympian. They've been in the Olympics. And they sense what got them there. They see the commitment. They see the drive and the desire. And that could infect the young kid and change their life. Just that one interaction.
That is so awesome. And just going back to the whole concept of skiing, is it's such an empowering endeavor that can be with you for life, right? And that's the great thing. And so get people exposed and then provide opportunities where they can afford to engage is fantastic. I think that aspirational pathway, though, although a lot of folks aren't going to become Olympians, very difficult, you know, here in the Upper Valley, right? It's kind of that, you know, that's this amazing area of a lot of Olympians, you know, whether that's Nordic jump, that's, you know, cross country, that's alpine. Michaela Schifrin lived down the road from where our kids are growing up, and they know that, right? And so that's a really exciting thing, you know. But speaking of that, and kind of the Olympic movement as an NGB, is it more about participation? Is it more about performance? And how do you guys manage that, right? For us, right? We're a sports entertainment company, so it's pretty clear that the performance piece. And even beyond that, getting the brand and people to enjoy being a part of that experience is number one. For us, the reason we started this is because we want to increase opportunities for people to be exposed to rugby, just because rugby is such an empowering sport. I mean, little kids, girls and boys running in the same game, same rules, making decisions with ball in hand, having total control, and then I get a tackle, right, in a safer environment than some of our other contact sports. So very empowering. So for us internally, that's why we started it. But it's pretty clear from a fiduciary responsibility, our responsibility is that performance on the field and, you know, to help the brand. How as an NGB do you manage that?
Well, you know, there's such a wide spectrum of engagement. So you can say, I guess the most casual and infrequent fan would be somebody who watches the Olympics. So it's the patriotism of turn, click the TV on, turn to NBC during the Olympics, and you almost don't care what sport's on. It's where are the Americans, how are they doing?
Yeah, it's awesome. And
it draws. Fortunately, it's still the greatest sports marketing property on earth, despite its challenges. And so what we really want to do is then have more people move forward from that stage. So in our sports too, we have fewer players, let's say, than we have participants. So there are a lot of people there's 18 million people that consider themselves skiers or riders in the United States. And very few of them actually compete or do when they're skiing and riding what the competition sports do. So they don't necessarily go in a half pipe when they're snowboarding. They don't necessarily go in the terrain park. They're enjoying the mountain, enjoying the outdoors, enjoying our sport. Our challenge is to convert them into also being a fan. So we have a huge number of participants who actually don't watch the sport, or they're not necessarily a fan until the Olympics rolls around. So that conversion is incredibly important to us. And then of all those people who try or are involved in the sports, or like you, where the parents have been in this, you know, doing the sport, skiing and riding, then having them hopefully in a location and in a situation where their kids can be in a club program. So for us, the sport entry actually is really more coincidental. If the parents want to go or they live near a resort, and then the competition entry is when they get involved with a club. And that's highly social, it's highly engaging, and then the kids get exposed to structured learning while they're loving and enjoying their sport. And hopefully some of them get super engaged in the higher level of the competition, and that's where you find the Bodie Millers, the Peekaboo Streets, that just come out of nowhere. And it's a combination of their family who's driven them to be passionate about whatever they do. They get hooked on our sport, and the two is a deadly mix, and they become very, very effective and contenders on the world stage. And our job is kind of two levels. So we lead the club. So we are an organization of ski and ride clubs around the country. And we do the best we can to help them run their programs. But they're really autonomous. Yeah. There's a lot of overarching things like safe sport and coach education and membership and insurance, just like any of the leagues in the U.S., rugby, one of them, lacrosse, et cetera. And then up through that system will come the elite ones. And each club usually has somewhat of an elite channel. You know, they might have, at least they have a way to accommodate and challenge the athlete who is gifted, working hard, skiing and riding a lot, and becoming great. But the most important thing is they are getting those members hooked on the sport. And that kid later becomes like you and has kids and happens to be able to be near a ski resort or travels, you know, on vacations and engages in the sport. So that's our kind of our grassroots role. And then our elite role is very much like a pro sports team. So it's harsh. It's tough. It's a sharply pointed pyramid, or if you think of it as a funnel.
I think it's the difference, right? I
mean, very few make it to the top. I mean, you go to a Little League game, you go to every Little League game in the country, and you ask around, well, how many of these kids are going to make it into the majors? It is a fraction of 1%. I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous. But it's the dream of chasing that is what's so fun. It's pursuing that and seeing how good and how far you get. And yeah, I was in two Olympics and I wouldn't say world contender, but I was top 10 at times in the world against the very best in the world. And, you know, I just bumped my way along there. I just kept getting better, hoping. And eventually at one point I thought, well, maybe I can be that good. When I got to that level, it was a game of, do I have the confidence to actually feel I belong in the top 10 in the world? And so, but it's the dream leading up to that drives everybody. And you become a great skier. And we're so lucky in our sport in skiing and riding, because just like you said, it can be a solitude, you in the mountain. It can be you and 30 friends coming and going during the day. It can be you and your spouse or significant other, or it can be you and your kids. I mean, so it's a team sport and a team and a family activity all the way through until you actually are competing. And then there's that image of, you know, Downhill Racer, the movie, right, with Robert Redford, and they're in the start of the Lauberhorn, which is a 2.5 mile dangerous, icy, up to literally 100 miles an hour downhill race, as you against the mountain. And there's a clock.
And that's a clock. It's very measurable. Going back to that, like, the revenue piece of this is really fascinating to me. So Piper, you know, at 3 years old, because her friends from daycare literally were at the skiway, she wanted to go skiing. Okay, great. And that's because of the social part of it. But then she has this freedom now because she's, you know, as a 5 year old, it's like her mountain, right? Very fortunate that we get that situation. Okay. I've been a part of the ski industry of the economy of skiing my whole life, right? Buying passes, buying skis, having experiences around skiing. How do you convert me in this game? You know, the Olympic Channel, love watching it. Like, our kids watch skiing. How do you convert us to revenue for the NGB? How do we become members? Like, why would we want to become members outside of maybe Piper decides to continue and do his Devo at Ford Sayre, and maybe that's how we become members? What if she doesn't? What if it's just purely the experience, the socialization of skiing that she loves, which is fantastic? How do we become part of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard?
Yeah, so that gets back to fans. You know, that's the ubiquitous thing. And so if we have an event or we have a superstar doing something special, and now, of course, athletes who have direct followings themselves and they are marketing machines themselves, much greater than ever so in the past. And, you know, it's the number of people who are watching and engaged. So it's not just eyeballs. So it's not just a TV commercial and how many people see it. So we generate revenue that way because we have world-class events we run, and with our partners at the resorts, and NBC airs them, our broadcast partner, and we receive revenue for that. But At the same time, we have 35,000 people who are members of the sports. The membership base, like swimming, soccer being the big ones, rugby's big too, you have members who are all chipping in, and that helps support the organization. It also pays for the insurance, the coaching, the sport education, et cetera, and the organization of all of that. And but what is so critical here is having commercial partners. And our, you know, we're lucky. We have major car company Land Rover. We have Visa. We have Comcast, Xfinity. And what they're looking for is the co-branded telling the authentic story of their products associated with people who are doing extraordinary things. And that's where you build tremendous value that isn't just counting eyeballs. That is building a love for a brand or an association with, you know, look at Michaela's going around the roadblock in the Land Rover commercial. And it's like, well, what that means, Land Rover's the mountain, life in the mountains vehicle, right? And so you can go on and on about, you know, Visa was when free skiing came about. So really like snowboarding, same venues, half pipe and slope style, but on twin tip skis. And that became an Olympic event. Visa jumped all over that because it was just such a freedom for kids all over the country who were skiing backwards and jumping stuff. And it was cool and fun. And you know what? We swept the Olympics in that sport and slope style in 2014.
And you didn't need to do that. You didn't need to live in Utah, Colorado.
No, I mean, Nick Gepper grew up in Indiana.
Yeah, that's awesome. So really the big conversion, not only the volume of members, so we become members because we get to feel a part of the brand, we get the sticker, we'll get the this was a lesson that I think USA Rugby we looked at a few years ago, right when you'd come on board. One of my colleagues, their kids had signed up for skiing. Letter from you, like a template letter from, you know, the head of U.S. skiing, basically like, here's the pathway to be a future Olympian. Welcome to our membership, which was just brilliant. So it started from the very beginning, the behavior norms, the aspirations, the wording, just out. This is the experience you could potentially have. And that was brilliant. You know, but with that, so we become members, fantastic. We get some insurance coverage and some other things like that, some opportunities for your partners, you know, the global rescues of the world. But I think if I'm hearing correctly, the real revenue generation comes because we then convert. If we can afford to buy a Land Rover, we convert, we buy this great mountain car because of its association and brand, and it's so cool because it's part of U.S. skiing. So that's kind of the model then.
Yeah, that's the commercial partnership part of it, which is significant. I mean, in terms of us as an NGB, it's typically 25% of our revenue. What we have, and we're so lucky as Americans, is in that huge participation base, many of them are also philanthropic supporters of us. And so many teams, hospitals, causes in the U.S. are in the game of hooking people to help. And we've been lucky. We've been able to do that. We have a tremendous number of donors and some very significant large donors who are associated with us. And we're able to share some of that experience with them, which is huge. Yes. And so that is a big part of what we, that's about a third of our revenue. So the US Olympic and Paralympic Committee also gives us a grant that's about 15% of our operating budget. So it comes from a lot of places. But we're just lucky to have a fan base that loves the sport and follows the sport, and in particular loves our athletes and the superstars that have done extraordinary things. And I also need to point out the biggest superstar base that we have amongst our athletes are female.
That's awesome.
This is one of the few sports that since literally the 30s and the 40s had equal female participation.
Awesome.
And some of the greatest, most notable athletes on our teams are Michaela Schifrin, Chloe Kim, and Lindsey Vonn. And there are others, many others. And they're global characters.
Yeah.
And so that's really cool. And we, you know, we're we try to tell that story. We're doing a better and better job telling that story. And we have some of the greatest athletes on earth, and they're not male. We have some of the greatest male athletes on earth too. But, you know, there's certainly been a lot about gender bias and gender equality, certainly within U.S. soccer, as we all know. And we're lucky in that sense. You know, it didn't take Title IX for us to be a very balanced sport in terms of participants.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think we as a sport, rugby, we take a lot of pride in that our rules are the same. It's a full contact sport, same size of ball for boys and girls, women and men. But there's a lot of lessons we've had to have and still have in that regard for equality. And we're continuing to move in that direction, hopefully. So that's a really good thing. Speaking of these all-star kind of athletes, these high performers, best in the world, you know, rugby in a lot of ways has really taken off as a performance sport on college campuses, where probably when, you know, back in the day, it was a keg on the sideline type of thing in the 70s and 80s on a lot of college campuses. But now it's actually professionalized, professional coaching. They're learning and chasing this aspirational dream of being Olympians, you know, with rugby sevens, men and women, and of course, professional players domestically and abroad. What does that take in your experience? Obviously, you've, you know, gone that path yourself as an athlete, but now you see it from kind of the top and over an organization that is really trying to help these athletes get to be the very best they can and the very best in the world. What's the difference, you know, especially in a sport that's measured by the, you know, the hundredths of a second? What are you seeing are the behaviors or the differences that, you know, young athletes can strive for or train for to be the difference?
Well, what I love about sports in general, sorry, my dog's going nuts in the background, is the, it's the metaphor for life, right? And it's how do you, and in particular, a team/not-team sport, which is most of ours, the concept of you really trying to improve, you're trying to use all the resources around you to get better. And typically, the athletes are bouncing from program to program, coach to coach to coach. You know, our research that we found, and I'm sure this is true in all sports, is essentially that there is a major figure in every great athlete's history. It may be a parent, maybe an uncle or an aunt. It a lot of times it's a coach, and it could be a coach from their youth who virtually follows them and supports them as they move up through the ranks. The coach doesn't go with them. It may be the high school coach. It may be the coach you had when you're 17, but you have an unusual bond with that person, and you draw from that person this feeling of they believe in you, and you draw tremendous confidence from that while you go into this uncharted territory of trying to move up through the ranks, which is daunting. But all along, you know, you've got Joe or Susie back home who believes in you, and you can call them. And today's world, FaceTime them at the beginning of the event, right before you compete. You know, back before that, you didn't have that kind of easy communication from a distance, but you still had enough contact. And so those mentors are huge, but it's an athlete learning how to learn from those around them and how to draw what they need from those around them, regardless of what team they're on. And again, we're really an individual sport. And so we try to teach our rookies, the ones coming onto our teams, we sit them down. The first thing I say to them is, we're here as an organization to help you. And you're lucky. You're named to a team. You got tremendous financial support. It's crazy the amount of money you get spent on them with travel and staff and et cetera. But we're just here to help you. We are nothing but a stepping stone for you. You have to figure out how to use us to get as much as you can out of us. And it might require you coaching us, telling us how we can be better, because we're not perfect. We're all trying. There's a lot of great people trying really hard, but it's a two-way street, and getting a young athlete to coach the coach is tremendously difficult, but that's where you create a crazy effective culture. And you have some, you know, amazing examples in rugby, as we know, especially, you know, a particular team on an island in the South Pacific. And it's extraordinary. And so if an athlete learns that early and they truly want to get to somewhere they just could never dream they could get to, and they work hard and they learn how to learn from everybody around them, And I used to ask to see young kids riding up the lift at the skiway. I asked this of Taylor Schifrin once, Michaela's brother, who was skiing with my son. And we were riding up the lift, and I asked my kids and Taylor, I'm like, who's your best coach? So what a trick question, right? And they thought, I'm waiting for them to say, I'm their best coach, because I was their coach, right? And they're hunting around. They're like, well, Steve or Bob or Joe or Julie. And I'm like, no, you are. You are your best coach. You have to figure out how to draw. And sometimes I kind of equate it to a buffet. You know, you go up to a buffet and you go through a line, you grab a little bit of everything, right? You go sit down, you eat it all, and you're like, well, I kind of liked that thing better than that thing. You go back and then you can become more selective. So as an athlete, you often are told, you've fed a tremendous amount of information. And athletes don't learn by thinking the three things at the same time. It's absolutely physically impossible. Just go try playing golf and see how you do when you have a lot of thoughts in your swing. If you're thinking a lot when you swing, you're going to have the worst day ever, right? But it's when you're just letting your body do what you trained it to do, you're going to do the best. So golf is an incredibly illustrative way of knowing, can you let your body do what you need to do? But you have to learn along the way from every single person.
I love it. And just going back to that, so collecting mentors, really, really important. Staying engaged with the mentor. Learning how to learn, though, I think is a massive concept and belief. You know, there's one of the U.S. teams we were working with, and there were some trust issues on the team and a few other things. But that was the thing we got them to, is that I believe that you believe in me. Like, so it was a two-way street. Like, I have belief that you actually believe in me to get me, which was an amazing piece of that. So I absolutely love that. Doug Lamov, who wrote Teach Like a Champion and Perfect Practice, he's going to be on the pod here pretty soon. You know, and that, those books changed my life as a coach, you know, early on in my coaching career. And that the whole concept of learning how to get better, the process of getting better, it is so crucial. And just how much the student, the player, the athlete has to be the advocate in that role and be driving that, and learn how to manage up and manage down, and learning those skill sets early on and continue to practice them and be in an environment where they can safely, I think is a really fantastic point. So Tiger, you have to perform every day. You have to execute every day as a CEO of a large NGB that has to perform at Olympics and, you know, deal with Lewis sponsors and this wide membership base that has a lot of needs. How do you manage it all?
It's a good question. Actually, with so much that has happened with COVID, I think it's taught all of us, it's beat up a lot of us in terms of, I mean, the amount of things that surprise you and then take a lot of attention that piles on. But at the same time, it's also forced us to simplify. And a lot of organizations like us are trying to downsize a little bit while the work level is going up. Yeah. So how do you do both, right? You really just realize what is important and what you need to focus on. Unfortunately, sometimes what you need to focus on is the most recent thing that has blown up or become very important. And so I almost feel speaking of learning and training, I almost feel like I've gone back to my sport at an athletic level. Every day something new gets thrown at me.
Yes.
And I either need to catch it, deflect it, or duck it.
I love that.
And
duck it. Okay, I love it.
It kind of raises your adrenaline level. You can't sustain that over time, but for some reason it feels like we've just become better at managing all this stuff because the anxiety level is just high enough to keep you on your toes, but not so high that it drains you and wrecks you. And, you know, of course, the whole COVID and shutdown in March, and we were trying to run major events in the United States too at the same time. And just the way that sort of ratcheted into a world of nobody's ever been here. And most of us in our generation haven't had something. This is just really weird and ubiquitous intimidating, and it stops everything and getting used to, well, how do we operate then? What do? How do we run this? How do we continue? Well, we can do that. We can't do that. Oh, we have to do that in a certain way. It has 15 ramifications to it. All the sports leagues and teams are going through this now too, right? Where you've got, okay, to control the virus, you do the following things, distance, this, and then you try to apply it to a stadium. Oh my gosh. the implications there. They're just, and I've been meeting a lot recently with our partners, our ski area operators, and some of them open in the summer. You know, the mountain bike parks like here at Deer Valley and Park City has the same. And I get the same feeling from the, you know, my fellow CEOs that are running resorts. They're just like, we plan and we have these scenarios and then we stop the meeting. We're like, everybody just stop. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So let's get in the ready position and not plan too far out. Talk about scenarios. So we too have like two different scenarios that are, you know, I would say economically down from where we would like to be. And one of them is kind of doomsday. And we have gone through the exercise of training. If this all hits, what are we going to do? So it feels like military training where you're training for battle, but you're not in battle. You're at the training center.
Yeah.
But then the ship might sail and go to battle. And, you know, the latest, Tom Hanks's latest movie Greyhound is all about this, right? They're on a destroyer in the Atlantic trying to protect a convoy, and they haven't been at war before. They're all, but they trained like crazy, and then they're dodging U-boats before they know it. And so watching that movie, it's like, I almost felt like it's ridiculous for me to say we're out there dodging, you know, German U-boats trying to sink our ship. But, it's amazing, and people have risen to a level, and the collaboration is incredible at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like our sport where we're all trying to get better, trying to help each other, but we also trying to beat each other.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I just went through a board meeting exercise a couple of days ago, and here's the problem, right? So we scenario out everything, but we got to make a choice, right? Because you're spending money here, or you're not spending money there, or you're spending money there, right? Or you're not spending, like, how are you doing it? Because what you don't want to have happen is come 6 months from now and you haven't done the work to be prepared for the new normal, whatever that may be. Right. Or on the flip side of that, you've resourced certain things that you're never going to get back in 6 months from now. That is going to be devastating. Right. So that's the hard part today. And you're right. It's been firefighting. And sometimes pre-COVID, we were firefighting so much, you got to the point where that's all you do all day. And so when it doesn't come, like, you can't actually transition to the real work and getting back into strategic thinking. That's been, I think, for me, one of the harder parts. When the COVID hit and everything else, it was actually an opportunity for us to say, well, hold on. Like, we're in the middle of a mountain here, basically, skiing down, and suddenly we can stop and decide how we're going to reset everything, right? 2 days before our inaugural match, you know, approaching sellout, great things are happening. But, okay, what's actually happening underneath that? And that's been a really, really, really good process to go through for the last couple of months. And in some ways, like a refresher that you never get. But now I think is the tough time. It's like, okay, now we actually have to make investment decisions. And that's the hardest part of kind of moving into to the next frame. Okay, outside of the craziness of everything, what is a typical day for you?
Spending most of the mornings, early mornings, talking to people in Europe. We have 250 athletes and staff that need to travel to Europe this fall. We have a little issue, which is known as the European Union has said you can't come here. Other than that, you know, no problem. So we train at Mount Hood, and we're training at Copper Mountain and other places in the U.S., which worked because we could travel state to state, fortunately, and do that. And the protocols are working. We've had very, very, almost no infection rates, which is great. And we're, you know, traveling by plane and bringing people into areas and testing them and isolating and quarantining them. And then there's 1,500 people on the hill at Mount Hood as I speak. But we also need to get our teams into Europe. So we're working through diplomatic channels to try to get that done. So that is like an added layer of we normally have quite a lot of travel and training going on in the off season now. We often go to New Zealand in August. That's not happening. We often go to Chile in September. That's not happening. So we're just trying to navigate this world in terms of we're here for our athletes. That's why we exist. So trying to set up the best athletic training. And our competitors are the ones, the Europeans, they're up on their glaciers having a good old time, you know, training like crazy. And we're doing that too at Mount Hood, but Mount Hood's going to melt in August and we're going to need to go to Europe. And then Really, the other part of it is our major events in the United States. So we hold up to usually about 16 world-level events, World Cups and Grand Prix, where the world comes here. Deer Valley, Beaver Creek, Killington, Copper, Mammoth Mountain, and there are other locations too. A problem if Europeans aren't allowed to travel into the U.S.,
yeah,
or other countries. So in the older sports, so I like to say really the Nordic and Alpine sports, those are really Central European based. The newer sports are more Asian and South Pacific. So freestyle, free skiing, snowboarding, have a ton of Brits that are very successful, New Zealand, Australia, Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. And so our events are, like you just said, working scenarios. What happens if we have to cancel them? What happens if we have to run them with certain distancing rules? We're lucky in that there isn't a big dependence upon large audiences like a stadium for revenue. It's mostly made for TV type things and local viewers, local spectators. So we don't know how that's all going to pan out, and we're just trying to plan through that. So again, it's sort of like this little boiling ocean of all these variables, and every day you go into them and you just, like you said, you know, it's like a good field sense, being on the field and the balls are coming from everywhere and the goals are moving, and it's like, wait a minute, and which way do you run? And now you run the other direction. You know, it's a little bit of a, I guess it would be, make a good movie.
Yeah, it's a massively good movie. Speaking of New Zealand, how great would it be in New Zealand right now? They shut everything down. Now they're getting, you know, 30,000-40,000 people at their rugby matches. Their Super Rugby is amazing. They've got the world audience from a rugby perspective. You know, a billion people watching their rugby right now because of what they did collectively and what their government did. And
yeah, extraordinary. Federal control. They had great national control.
Yeah,
and that's what we blew.
Yeah,
that's where we blew.
Exactly, and it's probably much easier to do in a two islands that have 4 million people versus our 330. And
yeah, true. There are more places to run in high, and you know, stay away from the virus in the U.S. and there in New Zealand. New Zealand's tiny.
Exactly, and what's the next frontier in sports? You know, I know you guys have an eye to the future, and you know, looking how you're going to keep engaging with your fans and continue to build your and just more communities, and what happens next?
Yeah, well, I think it's a combination of obviously the athletic and, you know, evolution of them, which ones become more popular, which ones suit themselves better for consuming digitally, and you know, the conversion to different ways of distributing content applies to us in spades. So you know, is it streamed? Is it over the top? Is it network only? Is there a 2-minute version of it that you'll actually pay attention to that shows you the top performances from that competition? That's what you want to see only. Is it following the superstar and knowing, you know, watching them brush their teeth and how they get ready for the competition and how they're feeling the night before and what they had for dinner? And you know what? The competition's less critical. More interesting to follow the athlete getting ready for the competition.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the world is changing. It's not necessary, but we are lucky as sports that we have an unpredictable outcome. And you have to watch it live to experience that uncertain outcome. Who's going to win? Which way is the ball going to go? Who's going to drop it? Who's going to catch it? Who's going to ski faster? Who's going to jump and fly further? That's the beauty and the lack of, well, now research, you know, getting them back on track. But when we had absolutely no sports content to broadcast, people were dying for it. I mean, when you didn't have it, you realized how critical it is to you. And it's just sport. It's not business. It's not feeding millions of people. It's not poverty. It's not racial diversity. It's about just watching something happen and people are doing it at a world-class level and you don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly. And that's the brilliant drama of it all. Yeah. The characters, the tension, the resolution, there's going to be a winner. It's fantastic. It's amazing. So heading into 2022, kind of where is US skiing? What can we expect? You know, kind of that, you know, you got almost Olympic time now, right?
Yeah.
quad, past halfway through the quad. What is for you a ski snowboard? What are expectations now?
Yeah, so we are entering the winter before the Olympics, and which is critical. You know, pipelines are long and some are short, and then they're full with certain people that get, we call them podium potential athletes. So people who are in a position where they could make a top three, and getting them into that position this season is critical. They don't actually have to make a top three this year, but they need to be in a position where going into next year, a year from now. And the Winter Olympics are now 6 months after the Summer Olympics. So the intensity of focus, and they're in a country that's very tricky to deal with, and ours are in China. And China is a very cold place. You know, it's a continental climate, and it can be windy and very cold where a lot of events being held. So how do you get ready for and adapt for that? Korea was the same way. It was absolutely freezing the first 10 days in Korea, in Pyeongchang. So trying to catch up on training we've missed, and trying to get our athletes to a position where they can be ready for the Olympic winter. I mean, we have world championships this winter too. So our sport, and every odd year we have a world championships. Will those happen? Will they happen on time? How's that going to pan out this year is in question. So frankly, the thing I worry about the most is the summer games, because the cascading effect from an interruption of the summer games next summer is so large. I mean, this has been terrible to date, COVID. That will dwarf everything, because the lack of revenue generation and monetary flow that comes from the Olympics will be so badly missed. It'll be hard for the movement.
Yeah,
really hard. And then if they cancel the summer games and ours is 6 months later, maybe it depends on the timing of a potential vaccine. But so getting ready for our games and training like nothing's different when everything is different.
Totally different. That's some conversations I've had with our U.S. Olympic athletes, just how difficult that was preparing for this summer. And now, wait a minute, it's another year of my life, right? I was planning on getting pregnant, or I was moving on to a real job, you know, outside of being an Olympian, and just that, how difficult. And then how my training, the intensity of my trainings, and how do I manage that? Where's my periodization peak, and just preparing myself at all, and that emotional craziness. Very, very challenging. But you guys then effectively, if you don't get certain opportunities, you're going to have to make investments now in certain podium potential athletes that may not, you know, that may not be a situation where they have a lot of time to play their way into the team for the competition, because there's not the same number of opportunities to ski their way or snowboard their way through competition into those opportunities. Is massively challenging.
Yes.
That is really tough. A couple of rapid fire questions for you. Tiger versus a grizzly.
Is it a single word answer or a phrase? I'm trying. Tiger versus grizzly?
Yeah.
Tiger.
Have you seen a grizzly?
No, just black bears, fortunately.
Yeah, we have a lot of black bears in Lyme. They're actually been great. They love to come into the orchard, but right now.
They get very friendly, yes.
Speaking of the cold, you can just send the entire team up to Mount Washington. They can just, you know.
High altitude training, 6,000 feet, yeah.
The wind up there, that would be great. Okay, the genie grants you one wish. You can't ask for more wishes. What would that wish be?
Youth success.
Love that. Absolutely love that. Favorite movie you've watched that stuck out? Obviously Greyhound
most recently. Yeah,
you check that out. What about book? Is there a book lately you've been like, you know what, I really connected with that, or whatever it may be?
You know, I love the culture books, the culture code, you know, even you know, Dan Coyle's so amazing.
Yeah.
But I'd say the culture code.
Talent Code was a game changer for me, because I was right when I was in my wheelhouse, you know, coaching the national team, and been looking at, okay, how are we going to change our progression here? Because a lot of our athletes hadn't had the same skill acquisition opportunities that the Kiwis had had, and you know, a lot of other rugby-centric countries. That was a fantastically good way and concise way to say, okay, here's best practices, and here's, you don't need 25 X, Y, and Z nifty things. It's just certain reps in certain situations are actually going to be the difference. So boil it down to those key reps. And for us at the time, it was like, okay, what is our competitive advantage then? Well, all our athletes grew up playing other sports, catching a ball over their head, you know, basketball, you know, even volleyball, baseball. We were able to quickly transition and dominate the restarts part of rugby sevens. And that's 2/3 of all possession in rugby. So we weren't actually good at rugby, but suddenly we started winning because that became our competitive advantage. A lot of that came from Dan's at the talent code, which was fantastic. Favorite Free Jacks merchandise?
I love all sports memorabilia stuff, t-shirts, hats.
Hey, what size are you?
I'm a medium.
Okay.
What do you got?
We got everything. We got a Hawaiian.
What size are you?
I go between large and extra large depending on the time of year. Is it rugby touch season or is it ski season? There's a certain amount of consumption of IPAs that go with one and not the other. So I go between the two. But we got some great gear actually. So. And last one, and this is what I ask everybody, if you were running the Free Jacks today, what would be your primary focuses? Okay.
Building a culture that is enduring, like figuring out how to make it permanent, even with all the changes, staff, people, athletes, you know, sweeping the sheds, whatever it takes.
How do you do that at US Skiing, that culture piece?
It's a huge challenge with so many moving parts and so many people with their own idea of how things work. Yeah. The best way to teach it is to mimic examples. And our cross country team is the poster child for us. And Keegan Randall really led that with her coaches. Yeah. And what happened there is you have world-class athlete who popped above their whole team and started winning. And she said, I need you guys here with me, and taught them how to be there with her.
That's awesome. They're great to watch. They compete so well. Love that. Tiger's amazing to have you on. I think the title of the podcast should be Wrestling a Tiger, How to Deflect It or Catch It, right?
There you go.
So good to see you.
Nice to you and your family. A lot of fun.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's Full Contact CEO. Join me next week as I have a very special guest, 3-time Super Bowl champ with the Pats, rugby Olympian, and technically my boss and partner in the Free Jacks, one of our co-owners, Nate Ebner. We discuss building a high-performance culture, competitiveness, and if Nate could run the Free Jacks every day, which of course he wants to, what would he be doing? How would he go about it? And a sneak peek into the life of a professional athlete.